real six.
The largest single number of our casualties came from the mortar line, where one of the base plates on the tubes had started to sink at a fairly critical time, and the crew had taken it in turns to support the mortar base plate with their foot, by pushing their foot under the base plate. Inevitably, this eventually broke their ankle, at which point the particular individual concerned had been dragged out and somebody else had taken his place. So I think we'd four or five casualties from this kind. They'd been treated and left down by the mortar line. And really, the biggest problem for us was trying to get the helicopter in to locate us so that we could get these casualties out. Casualties that we were receiving within the companies, and they were actually relatively light, were effectively bypassing us. They were being treated by the company medic, and the light helicopters were picking up casualties almost to the rear of the company location and taking them straight back to Teal Inlet, where there was a forward dressing station for treatment. And we really had few casualties. One of the scimitars of the Blues and Royals came in with its commander incapacitated. We thought he'd perhaps been hit by shrapnel, but as I was on the turret pulling him out, the gunner told me that it wasn't anything to worry about, it was just hatch rash. And when I asked him what hatch rash was, he said, "Oh, it's just the hatch turret hatch had simply slammed down on the back of his head, hadn't been properly secured, and had knocked him out." So we hauled this fellow out, and he got a nasty gash across the back of his head, and he was eventually medevaced, and the vehicle drove off to continue the battle. When daylight came, we were still under sporadic artillery fire, and I went up to main headquarters, which was really just on the crest of the hill. They were waiting to hear from TAC headquarters with regard to whether they would be moving or not. So the RAP also prepared to move. We were becoming really quite experienced by now. During the course of the night, one soldier who was from defence platoon, whose task had been to carry stretchers, and he'd been carrying ammunition forward and bringing casualties back over very difficult ground. It was a very, very hard job. And a carry of a kilometre was taking well in excess of an hour. Well over an hour with casualties on it, and these soldiers were exhausted. This lad had appeared and said he'd been told to get his head down for a couple of hours. Where should he do it? So somebody, it may have been Steve Hughes, said, "Oh, you know, just go over the hill there, just over the top." He went over the top, lay down, and a few minutes later we heard a loud bang from that direction as an artillery round landed. And a few moments later he appeared and said he thought something had hit him. So at which point Steve Hughes said, "Well, you know, does it hurt?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, does it seem to have damaged you?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well, come back in daylight. It's not a lot I can do now." And the lad came back. He stopped a splinter, which hadn't been too damaging. But we then moved forward with main headquarters, or at least we started to move with them. And by now, as well as the RAP and I and main headquarters, attached to us was defence platoon, who'd been doing all of the stretcher bearing, which made the numbers up to probably about 40 to 50 men in all. Steve Hughes, the doctor, was suffering increasingly from an ankle which he damaged when we landed, and was finding it increasingly difficult to walk. I'd heard from main headquarters that we'd had casualties in D Company, and at least one dead. And then I got a rather odd and unexpected message saying that there was a gazelle coming, a helicopter coming, for me, and that I should use this for the dead. Well, when the helicopter arrived, it was quite clear that we couldn't really use it for the dead, not least of all because we hadn't located them, but also because it didn't have the pods that we needed on the skids, and the helicopter's not wide enough to get a body in across it. Since these casualties had been out in the cold for some hours, I knew they'd be stiff, and I knew there'd be no way we could get them in the gazelle. But it seemed a good idea to to get Steve Hughes forward in it. So I shoved him in the helicopter and told the pilot to drop him on Wireless Ridge overlooking Moody Brook, which we knew was now occupied by our TAC headquarters, A Company having gone forward down the hill into Moody Brook and on towards Stanley. And I then followed with the rest of the RAP and defence platoon of about, let's say, 40 men. Sometime later, before we'd reached Wireless Ridge, or at least Moody Brook, I heard over the radio that there was a possibility that white flags were flying in Stanley and that we shouldn't engage the enemy. So I instructed all the soldiers who were with me that they'd to make safe and that they wouldn't engage the enemy unless the enemy engaged us first. We got to Wireless Ridge where Roger Miller, to Moody Brook, where Roger Miller, our ops officer, confirmed that it did look as though the Argentines had surrendered and that we'd all got to stay where we were whilst General Moore went forward. I didn't like that, and I remember saying to him, well, you can stay, but I'm going down to Stanley with the RAP, because if you've got two companies down there and they have any contact, they're going to need medical attention. But quite frankly, I said, I thought we should all get down into Stanley as quickly as we could, because if the Argentines were thinking about packing it in, if we stayed back where we were simply doing nothing other than giving them the opportunity to recover. And it would be much better that we pressed forward while we could. Anyway, I said, I'm going with the RAP, and I went back to the RAP and said, right, lads, berries on, which raised the cheer, so everybody put their red berries on. And we set off. And I was about to walk down the hill to Moody Brook, and somebody from the intel said, well, that's mined. Well, it looked as though a football crowd had gone down it. There were footprints everywhere. So I said, well, I reckon we're fairly safe going down there. There's so many people gone before us. So we walked down onto the metal road at Moody Brook itself, and then continued down that road past the seaplane hangar into Stanley. And I noticed that behind me was the rest of the battalion. So either Roger Miller had thought again, or perhaps he'd been told that he should bring the rest of the battalion forward. And we walked down and into Stanley. We passed some members of 3 Para who'd come off the Longdon area and got down into the Stanley by the race course, and then began to catch up with our own battalion, who were moving into buildings around the race course, including the building that had been used as the Argentine officers' mess. There were 2 Argentine dead on the road as we went into Stanley, and I covered them with a couple of sheets of corrugated iron and bits and pieces of rubbish that were lying round. One or two houses to the right were burning, and I subsequently discovered that these were the houses that had been hit by a Royal Naval bombardment, and in which 2 of the women, the only 2 civilian casualties, had been. We eventually found a shed, a woodshed, in the garden of a house where we put ourselves up temporarily whilst the battalion sorted itself out. I went to main headquarters to discover that we only held the eastern part of the town, and that roughly in the area of the war memorial, not the war memorial, government, not government house, the administrative buildings, the Argentines held the lines there, and the other half of the town. Well, that night we heard a lot of noise from the Argentine half of the town. The power was cut, water went off, and it soon became clear that there was very little discipline amongst the Argentines. And when I saw David Chandler after daybreak, he said, enough's enough, we're moving into the other half of the town. And indeed the Argentines moved off, presumably this was after the surrender. And I walked down to find the vicar in Stanley. David Chandler had said we weren't allowed to march. The task force had been told quite clearly there'd be no victory marches through Stanley, which seemed a pity. But we'd both talked jokingly, and I'd continually pulled soldiers' legs a bit about the only reason we were going to Stanley was so that we could have a service in the church there. And it more or less came up between the two of us, I think, that's David Chandler and I, that we could have a service in the church at Stanley. And of course, to get there, we'd have to march to the church. And although we couldn't hold a victory parade, we would actually at least be marching through the town. And I went down to see Harry Bagnall, the dean there, and he was helpful, said, yeah, by all means use the church. And a few of the islanders who I spoke to as I went by, inevitably, because they were pleased to see us, said, is there going to be a parade? And I said, no, but we're marching up to the church tomorrow. So when we marched up to the church, there was a reasonable turnout of islanders to cheer us on the way. And that service was the service that was subsequently, it seems, broadcast to the entire world. I didn't realise, I was asked, Bob Fox was there. Well, by now Bob Fox was more or less part of the battalion, and I knew he was working for BBC, for the radio. And he said, would I mind if he recorded it? And I said, well, of course not. And then somebody else came along and said, would I mind if it was videoed? And I said, who for? And I said, I was told, oh, it's for an army documentary. So I said, well, it doesn't really matter. I don't mind at all. And we had our battalion service. And it wasn't until I started getting all sorts of letters from people I didn't even know that I realised that, in fact, this thing had been broadcast and had made a much greater impact on the people back at home than I could ever have imagined. And I, to this day, really don't quite know why it made such an impact, because there wasn't a great deal in it that was particularly something significant. I think all I did was stand up and say how we all felt. I don't think I was saying anything to soldiers that they didn't feel themselves or weren't aware of. But nevertheless, it did seem to make some sort of impact. But we were just relieved. We knew the Argentines hadn't surrendered, at least in Argentina, so there was always the possibility of air attack. So we were still on quite a high state of alert. The RAP and I accommodated ourselves in what had been a school, which the Argentines had made into a military hospital. And we really had quite comfortable accommodation. The town itself was absolute shambles. There was rubbish everywhere, every kind of kit you could imagine. The Argentines had no discipline of any sort, it seemed. They'd certainly no hygiene. Again, they defecated wherever they wanted to, it seemed. They destroyed things. I went down to the local civilian hospital where I met Alison Bleaney and her husband, and then he asked me if we'd any coffins, and I said no, we hadn't, we only had body bags. And he told me that these two women had been killed. He seemed very bitter about it, and I wouldn't say, I mean, it didn't really upset me too much, but it's about the only time any of the islanders seemed in any way to be reproachful to us. And he really did seem a bit bitter that these women had been killed. And yet, I understood that the Argentines had made it quite clear that that was the military end of town. And the husband of one of these women, who I believe was a dentist, who was there, said, you know, well, we have our right to live in our own houses. But it did, you know, he was talking to the wrong person. I'd buried too many of my soldiers to feel that two ladies who elected to stay in what was quite clearly a dangerous bit of the town were going to get a great deal of sympathy from me at that time. But as far as the coffins went, all I could tell them was that I knew we didn't have any, but we did have body bags, and I was quite sure that if they wished I could get body bags. They said they didn't want to take up that offer, and I think they did get coffins, but where they came from I don't know. But those two ladies were buried, presumably again by Harry Bagnall, because I don't think it was a service chaplain involved. And we really just wanted to go home. We started to clear up as best we could, but the Argentine prisoners, of whom there were an enormous number, were taken home first in such shipping as we had. And it wasn't until they'd all gone that we were able to embark on the Norland and go back. Now, Chris Keebler had said on and off that he really wanted some sort of memorial at Goose Green before we left, and he'd gone and he'd got hold of the manager at Goose Green, the Falkland Islands manager, company manager, and cajoled him into making a small cairn with a cross on it. And we got a Chinook, and as many of us would fit in it, fitted into it, and we flew back to Goose Green, where we had a short service, and then returned. The Chinook actually dropped us on the race course from where we really almost just walked across the road into a landing craft, which took us out to the Norland. We got on board and within hours set sail. And that was the last I saw of the Falkland Islands. We sailed quite wide to Ascension Island, and from there we flew back to UK in a VC-10. And in fact, I think we're the first troops back. The Prince of Wales was there to meet us at Bryce Norton, as were our families, but there were no other crowds. There was nothing like the arrival of the Canberra subsequently. We, on the boat between Stanley and Ascension Island, we unwound quite a lot, and it coincided with Airborne Forces Day, so there was really quite a party on that occasion. But I think in general we were all coming to terms with the experiences, and it was generally a fairly quiet sort of time with individuals just talking to each other and preparing themselves for when we got home. And really, that I suppose was about it. We had the dead repatriated in October of that year, which again, I wasn't entirely happy about the way that was done. We'd buried them properly on the battlefield, and inevitably they were, the next of kin were given the choice of repatriation. And I suppose it was inevitable that they would be given a full burial service again. But for those of us who went on the road, and in the case of the parachute regiment, I ended up with in the region of 50, it can't have been that many, maybe about 30 bodies that were repatriated, of whom about 15 were buried in the Aldershot Cemetery. So we had the service for those. A number were buried in local cemeteries by local clergy, but the remainder that requested a military military funeral were buried again by me, and I simply went on tour for about 2 weeks with a firing party and a bearer party, and we did one or two funerals a day from places as far afield as Belfast, Glasgow, Perth, right down to Canterbury, Norfolk. It was a very, very wearing time, and for the soldiers that were with me and me, we'd really only just started, I think, coming to terms with our own losses when we found ourselves back in this situation of all these funerals of people we'd buried once and whose death we really thought we were coming to terms with. But I think it helped the next of kin, and if for that reason alone, it was, I think, a worthwhile exercise. But I think that's about the sum total of my story.
Did the Falklands War change your own attitude towards war?
No, it didn't. It let me see what war's like. It made me feel subsequently I was much more competent to do my job. It brought me much closer to the people I served with and much more remote from those back at home. And I think one phenomenon I noticed was how most soldiers I spoke to felt that they never would be, they could never explain what it was like to those who'd not been in war. So it was almost that they felt themselves to be forever divorced from the population that had sent them to war. And that however much that population might congratulate them and cheer them, they would never understand what conflict was like. So in that sense, I feel the one change is that I feel, as it were, a member of a club. The membership fee is only understood by those who've been in combat. And I wouldn't limit that to the Falklands. I think probably anybody who's been in combat at the front line. I think it's something which is you cannot describe. And one who hasn't undergone it can't really understand it.
Does it mean a kind of sense of resentment to the community
you're sending? I don't think there's resentment, though it could easily become that. Maybe, I'm not a psychiatrist, maybe a psychiatrist would say that it might be a resentment that leads to some of the violence that has occurred from those who've been involved in war when they've got back home. And I certainly remember talking to one sailor who'd become a casualty, who said when he was back at Portsmouth and the war was still on and people were sitting there having their holiday and the war was just something that they heard morning and evening, he said, I really wanted to get a hold of them and actually physically shake them and, you know, shake them out of their complacency. So I could see how it could become resentment, but I think most of us felt we'd taken our pay in peace. And the government was now simply asking us to do what it had been paying us for so long for. And we obviously were going to do that as best we could. But I think we all felt, in a curious way, closer to the Argentines who'd been fighting than we did the people back here. Because they were the only ones who really knew what it was like.
We hear quite a lot nowadays after wars about the need for counselling, which is something that the Second World War soldiers and people from wars of that vintage never had and seem to be a bit astonished about. What's your own opinion about that?
I think there are some who will need counselling. I think the best counselling is by leaving soldiers together with those with whom they've fought. I think the mistake we made when we came back was to bomb burst on leave immediately for a long leave. I think we would have been better sticking together for longer. I think the best counselling for a person who's been in combat is to be with those who've been with him. And perhaps this is why it wasn't necessary after the Second World War, or perhaps this is why so many reunions occurred after the Second World War, that there was counselling, but it wasn't called that, it wasn't recognised as that. It was the participants being able to meet with those with whom they'd fought and talk things through between themselves, and I think that's the best counselling that can happen. I think the other difference as well between the Second World War and this war is that the civilian population in the Second World War had actually been under threat as well. There'd been the Blitz, there'd been the bombings in Coventry and other industrial cities. And so a lot of soldiers came back to a population who knew themselves what that fear was like. So again, you were talking to a person who'd been bombed, who'd got an understanding of what combat was like, and almost the blind chance that makes one person a casualty and the other one not. Whereas for us, coming back from the Falklands, we came back to a population who didn't know what combat was like, who hadn't been bombed and who hadn't themselves run the possibility of becoming casualties. And so the gap was greater. But I think even going further back to the First World War, it seems to me that what I read describes soldiers who were happier in the trenches amongst friends who were taking the same chance than they were on leave back in England amongst people who were gung-ho and didn't understand. And if you read books such as books were written by people, one that sticks in my mind particularly is I've forgotten his name, he was in the South Wales Borderers, And he wrote a book called Old Soldiers Never Die.
Yes, I know the book.
He wrote two books, and they were edited by Robert Graves. And he'd been in the Indian Army. Old Soldier Sahib, and maybe an Old Soldier's Fade Away. But when he left the Army, and this was before the First World War, but having served for 7 years in India, he found it impossible to accommodate civilian life, and he became a tramp for a while. But he made him, I would say a tramp, he walked the roads, but each day he set himself a target, as he would have done had he been on a route march with his battalion in India. It was Frank something or other, the fellow's name.
Yes, I know.
Frank Grieve, anyway. But it struck me that here was a man who would have nowadays have been described as suffering post-traumatic stress. He'd undergone military service. Something had happened to him in that service which had made it impossible for him to live a normal life as a civilian. And I've met the same phenomenon amongst survivors from Piper Alpha, from the Clapham Rail disaster, the King's Cross Rail disaster, the Hillsborough Football Stadium. I think where there is premature death, those involved that survive are very often left finding it very difficult to accommodate normal living. Now, it may be that our society has got different values from those of 1939 to 45. I think perhaps we are more. We do value life more highly now than was the case 50 years ago, and certainly the case of 80 years ago. So maybe this is why a survivor of combat needs perhaps, in some cases, treatment or counselling that wouldn't have been needed in the society of 50 years ago.
You mentioned the enemy. Did you come across any soldiers who hated the enemy?
No, I didn't. Felt sorry for them. And I remember certainly one of our senior NCOs, when we were collecting prisoners at Goose Green, saying to me, you know, it could so easily have been us. And there was general sympathy, and on occasion giving our Argentine prisoners some of our own rations. One soldier made a complaint, I think a formal complaint is perhaps too strong a word, but he certainly complained to me and took his complaint further, after he'd escorted prisoners back to Ajax Bay. And the prisoner handling parties at Ajax Bay, in his opinion, were treating the prisoners too harshly. And he said, if I can treat them well, and it was after all me they were trying to kill, I don't see why they can't treat them properly back at Ajax Bay. But the only time there was any feeling towards the Argentines, I think, was when Jim Barry had been killed. And certainly amongst D Company and his platoon, I think where the immediate reaction was one of belief that, or reaction to the belief that it had been a deliberate ploy to lure Jim out into the open where he could be shot, where they got very angry. I don't think there was any resentment to the Argentines. Again, when we got to Stanley, there was a bit of a feeling some of the Argentine officers were not worth anything, and there was a feeling of perhaps sympathy towards the Argentine soldiers. I certainly made contact with three or four Argentines and a couple of them to whom I wrote for some years afterwards. One who'd lived in Barrow in Furness, his father had worked for Vickers and was a medical student who'd been conscripted.